This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
...of war, injustice, and oppression. Today on our program, Bill Resnick talks with Gerald Markowitz, who teaches at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and writes extensively on the chemical industry and the feeble regulatory apparatus that attempts to monitor and control its devastating effects on the environment. Ivan Hale, who has extensive experience working in the criminal justice system, is going to discuss the vast differences between jails and prisons. I will be reading an article by Adam Lee about declining religiosity in the U.S., Concluding our program today, Movie Mole's Jan Hawken and Joe Clement are reviewing the current blockbuster from Hollywood, The Great Gatsby. Now here is Bill Resnick talking with Gerald Markowitz about the chemical stew that industrial pollution has and continues to brew.
Gerald Markowitz, welcome to KBOO.
It's nice to be on.
Gerald Markowitz teaches at John Jay College, a part of the City University of New York, with a longtime friend and collaborator, David Rosner. Gerald Markowitz has written Deceit or Denial, The Deadly Politics of Industrial Pollution, amongst other books. I recently read an essay they wrote, How Americans Became Exposed to Biohazards in the Greatest Uncontrolled Experiment Ever Launched. Gerald Markowitz, tell us about that experiment, and how does it feel to be a lab rat?
Well, unfortunately, we're all lab rats. There are about 80,000 chemicals that are being used in the United States today, and less than 1% of them have been fully tested. So in another 20 or 30 or 40 years, some of us are going to get sick from some of these chemicals, and then we'll be able to let people know which chemicals are unsafe and which aren't. It sounds like a crazy way for us to be able to have a economic and political system.
You wrote that the Centers for Disease Control have now begun monitoring some of the chemicals. Out of the 80,000, they've chosen 151 to assess the concentrations, right, that are built up in the various parts of the human body. Is that what they're doing?
Yes. In fact, now they've tested over 200 chemicals. And they've actually found that chemicals like fire retardants that are on a wide variety of sofas and chairs and bedding and children's materials are in all of us. And some of those flame retardants are carcinogens. You know, the nonstick coating Teflon is in just about all of us. BPA, which is short for bisphenol A, which is a plasticizer and causes disruption to the endocrine system and development of fetuses and children, also is in virtually all of us. So these are all chemicals that are potential carcinogens that cause other kinds of health effects. And they accumulate in people, and it's almost impossible to get rid of them. We live with them for a lifetime.
What do you say when not only the Environmental Protection Administration, but also all the chemical companies and lots of scientists who they hire say, oh, but sure, they're probably there, but in concentrations so low that they couldn't possibly cause any trouble, and we feed them to rats in those concentrations, and you know, these rats live, they're fed right and treated nicely for long lives. How do you deal with that argument?
Well, the unfortunate part is that we don't have that information for over 99% of the chemicals that are in the marketplace and in the environment. And so they may be right about some of those chemicals, but it's such a tiny percentage, and we're playing Russian roulette with all the other chemicals. We have become the lab rats. We're the ones who are going to be testing these chemicals so that future generations of scientists and public health people will be able to know which ones are dangerous and which ones aren't.
You know, it always seemed to me that we're not only testing individual chemicals, we're testing the sort of impacts and what happens when you create this chemical stew. Because a lot of these chemicals work with one another. I mean, have sort of effects on one another, it seems to me, that, and even indeed create new chemicals. Is that a concern?
That's a really important point because, for the most part, these chemicals are tested individually as if they exist in our bodies without any relationship to any other chemical that may be there. But you're absolutely right that we don't know what the potential effects are of these chemicals reacting with other chemicals, and the result is most likely not good.
Yeah, very unlikely not good. You know, you might get a mutation out of them that gives us wings and we sort of fly off to the next planet, but that seems to me very unlikely, actually.
That would be a good result. At least we'd have an escape plan.
And not only that, my ankles are bad, so this would be something that I could really, you know. There's also, it seems to me, another thing. It's not just chemicals and it's not just us. All of these chemicals, there's a whole lot of, first, a billion, and I mean, what are not billions and trillions, but trillions of trillions of trillions of various kinds of bacteria and whatever, little microorganisms of a million kinds, and more of them every year, partly because we've learned how to reproduce them with new genetic components that make them actually new species, and they're introducing all that stuff into this chemical stew. And some of those life forms, some of them are going to be super toxic in time, it seems to me.
We're really playing with fire with those. And the other kind of material that's being introduced without any regulation are what are called nanoparticles. It's the chemical version of those bacteria. And they are being put into our cosmetics. They're being put into our sunscreens and variety of materials. And we have not the slightest idea what these extremely small particles that can go through the skin and what effect they're going to have on us, just like those bacteria.
And furthermore, I mean, it's not just us, right? We've had nuclear weapons, right, for 70 years, and gosh, none of them have gone off yet. There haven't been a nuclear war. But time goes on, and once you create this sort of an environment with those threats, and the nuclear threat is a small one in comparison to what's likely to happen with all these chemicals and biological varieties, they're all swimming together. It seems to me it's a recipe, ultimately, for some super predator, I mean, maybe a micro one, that would create famines and destruction of crops. It seems to me it's a recipe for mass death and who knows what, various life forms.
Well,
am I wrong? I mean, is that just alarmist?
Well, I mean, you think about the warnings that Rachel Carson gave in 1962 with Silent Spring, and the effects of pesticides on the environment. And we think about the warnings that began in the 1970s about global warming and how we have not heeded those warnings as a result of chemicals in the environment. This is a very frightening situation. And it doesn't seem like there is a willingness on the part of the chemical companies or even the government to take this seriously. I mean, one of the worst things about our system is that we treat chemicals like they're indicted murderers. Indicted murderers are seen as innocent until proven guilty. Chemicals should be considered guilty until proven safe. And the result of not considering them guilty is that they're placed in the environment and we all have to wait and see what harm they're going to cause us before we can take them out of circulation.
And those chemicals, they're really expanding the numbers, right? Every year, more and more of them. In the 1950s, the number that we're bathed in is far, far less than it is now. And it just keeps growing, right? These chemical companies are constantly producing new things that somehow, you know, keep food safe or whatever, for bacteria from growing in food for a few weeks or something.
There are 700 new chemicals that are put into the marketplace every single year. And for the most part, these are not tested.
The weird thing is we test drugs, right? New drugs are tested. So,
yes.
And tested pretty exhaustively, actually. of course, they're also getting into the whole toxic mix, right? I mean, all of us are now bathed in statins, you know, the popular drugs, right?
Right.
They all get into us. But at least those are semi-tested, although the interaction effects aren't. But none of these are. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Gerald Markowitz, who wrote an essay, How Americans Became Exposed to Biohazards in the Greatest Uncontrolled Experiment Ever Launched. And we're, of course, the guinea pigs in that experiment. We were talking about the threats and in fact, how the people who should be thinking about and regulating the threats aren't, including the companies and the government. People have been saying this for a long time, and science fiction is full of stories that talk about this dilemma. I mean, it's certainly semi-understood, and it's certainly understood by people like you and many scientists. How come nothing is being done?
Well, I think that people somewhat naively believe that chemical companies and business in general would not harm us, either intentionally or unintentionally. I think that people believe that businesses are run by people like us and that we as individuals would not harm other people. But unfortunately, we have plenty of examples, the tobacco industry, the lead industry, the asbestos industry, and you know, PCBs and others, where the fact that there has not been regulation has led these companies to use products and to hide research and to deny problems. And in the words of David Michaels, who's the head of OSHA now, to create doubt. He quotes as his title of his book, the famous tobacco industry memo, where they said, doubt is our product. And I think that the media plays a very important role in pushing that kind of idea and reinforcing that idea, because the mainstream media loves the controversy. And it doesn't matter if there's any legitimacy to one side or the other. There's a controversy, they give both sides, even if there is no legitimacy to one side.
Yeah, and of course, companies themselves put in a whole lot of effort in demonstrating that they love the people and they're doing everything for us. And
absolutely.
And what they do, you know, better living through chemistry. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Gerald Markowitz, who wrote the book Deceit and Denial, The Deadly Politics of Industrial Pollution, and writes about many other forms of not just pollution, but various kinds of biohazards that really are threatening and are going to do us in if somebody doesn't do something. So what is to be done, Gerald Markowitz?
Well, one of the encouraging signs is that at least 27 senators have introduced the Safe Chemicals Act in Congress this year, and that act would require the EPA to test all chemicals to show that they are safe before they're put into the marketplace, as well as to test the variety of chemicals, the thousands of chemicals that are already in the marketplace. And that is something that I hope that people will get behind, because it's a very practical way of beginning the process of us knowing which chemicals are safe and which are likely to kill us.
Yeah, my guess is the testing industry is probably going to be on your side on that one, but I suspect that's not going to happen in the next couple of years. As we say on KBOO so often, unless there's a popular movement that is in fact demanding it. You see the signs of people waking up, of, let's say, health and safety committees in the workplace that were actually building in the late 60s and 70s, and I think been, like the labor unions themselves, smashed. But what do you see with regard to sort of building that kind of force that can demand protection and a different productive system?
Well, I think you raise a very good point, which me as a historian really relates to, and that is that there have been other times in our history where people have come together and demanded change. And certainly the 1960s was a major era when people in the labor movement, people in the environmental movement, ordinary people, consumers, demanded that the government protect us. And we would not have gotten the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. We wouldn't have gotten the Consumer Product Safety Commission. We wouldn't have gotten the EPA if those movements had not been active. And I take a lot of solace from the fact that there are environmental groups all over the country. They have not gotten together. They've not made an impact on a national level. But I think the raw material for a broad environmental movement to demand the kind of fundamental change that you're talking about is there.
Yeah, and I think you probably see it in actually the growth of organic agriculture and the support for it, and the sort of the fear of cancer and some of the new diseases that are clearly occurring. You know, that study of sperm counts going down all over the, especially in the industrialized world, and not just in frogs and alligators who have deformed, you know, the epidemic of sort of deformed genitals in those species, but of human beings, sperm counts are really falling. Am I right about that?
Yes, and scientists are relating that directly to the endocrine disruptors such as bisphenol A and the phthalates and others that are in everything that we are surrounded with. They're in the lining of the tuna fish cans that we eat or any canned food. They're even on the receipts we get from our credit cards. And they're, you know, in a variety of bottles. So these are everywhere, and scientists have documented the effects on a variety of animal species.
So do you think we can build a movement amongst men who sort of goes to the heart, I suspect, of some forms of maleness, and also to women? Can we appeal to help build a movement based on these sort of the effects of these chemicals? It seems to me the fall of sperm counts is a real, you know, canary in the coal mine.
Well, I agree, and we need, you know, a variety of environmental groups, and I think groups like the Environmental Defense Fund are raising these issues. It's got to be more broad-based, and it's got to get into the popular literature.
Gerald Markowitz, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you.
So long. I'm
That was a song called Watch It Die by Bad Religion. And you're listening to the Old Mo Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Prisons or jails? What's the difference? And if you must be incarcerated, is one preferable to the other? Here's the Old Mo's Ivan Hale to fill us in.
Thanks, Tom. Good morning. Recently, I've started watching the late 90s television epic Buffy the Vampire Slayer. For those of you who don't know, Buffy was a teenage girl who begrudgingly found herself chosen to stop evil creatures from opening the Hellmouth that lies beneath Sunnydale, California, and ushering in Armageddon. Aside from the obvious, the show takes a few liberties with reality. As I bemoan these things, my girlfriend whispers, "Willing suspension of disbelief, Ivan." I frown and grouse, but eventually let it go and continue watching. I'm okay with vampires sounding like rabid dogs, people who become hyenas, and polo shirt-wearing ghouls. Fine, I expect that. What bugs me are the more technical violations, like more than 6 bullets coming out of a revolver, or accurate aim while speeding in a car at night on wet streets, or the misuse of the terms jail and prison. Jail and prison are not the same. They are not interchangeable, not at all. Having experienced both firsthand, I will explain why. First, a definition. Jails are temporary holding places for people who have not been convicted of a crime and are awaiting trial. Jails are also places where minor sentences, no longer than 365 days, are served for misdemeanors or parole and probation violations. Jails are run by counties. If you are in a jail, you are under the jurisdiction of the county you are housed in. However, most states have a county of origin policy, which means the county of your first conviction, you will be released to that county. This can be a source of major problems for people who have committed their original offense, say, 10 years ago and haven't resided in their county of origin for years, if ever. Just imagine being dropped in a strange town with no support, knowing no one, and being expected to rehabilitate. Anyway, I digress. Technically, the main difference between jails and prisons is time and turnover. The National Institute of Corrections states that on average, a 1,000-bed jail turns over its bed 36 times in 1 year, totaling a population of 36,000. A 1,000-bed prison, on the other hand, averages a turnover of about 750, giving it an annual population of about 1,750. Because jails are temporary, there are few services or programs available to inmates, so there was almost nothing to do, especially in the poorer counties that cannot afford, or those counties who do not wish to afford services. If jails are the freeway off-ramp motels with no HBO, prisons are their Ritz-Carlton stepmothers. Prisons are long-term, state-run, or corporate-run, God help us, institutions. People go there who have been convicted of a crime in court and have been sentenced to serve a minimum of 366 days. Prisons are generally much cleaner and have far more services and programming. One can attend college programs, drug treatment, religious services, Buddhist, Christian, Wicca, Native American sweat lodges. There's entertainment, movies, TV, music, etc. To be absolutely clear, there is nothing good about either of these forms of human containment. They are two sides to the same dirty penny. Jails, though, are terrible in a way that prisons cannot touch. When I was interning as a parole officer in Bellingham, Washington, I would make a trip weekly to the jail there. It was a job no one wanted, so as intern, I did it, and frankly, I was happy to do it because it meant a chance to get out of the office. It is hard to describe in words the experience of jail. Most of my time was spent in the men's general population dorms. These dorms were large rooms, about 1,000 square feet, enclosed by glass. The passageways to get there were subterranean, dark, harshly lit, and the walls covered with grime. Temporary housing means little cleaning. Think rental home with high turnover. Coming upon one of these glass rooms was like a view of a macabre circus of masculinity. The testosterone was so thick it hung in the air like diesel smoke. Men with no shirts on playing cards, yelling, posturing, peals of laughter with no mirth or joy. Meth addicts with their blackened, toothless grins, everyone in the requisite dirty gray sweatpants with or without dingy white t-shirts, muscles and tattoos bulging and sweaty. The only way I could talk with the men was to kneel down and speak through the food tray slot. When opened, a blast of air holding the smell of 30 confined men would rush my face, blowing my hair back. The smell of caged men, of fear, sickness, violence, desperation, panic, depression, stagnation. The smell of time languishing, moving backwards, regressing to primate. Some of these men would be still high off of whatever drug they were on when they were arrested. Some would be detoxing or coming down in great pain, drug sick. I would have to put my face near the opening of the food tray slot to hear anything, and as you can imagine, weeks of spilled food had collected and built up, creating a hardened spackle of black grime. Grown men would cry to me through the slot, begging me to talk with their parole officers about their case, begging me if their POs had forgotten them. Imagine being confined and having no idea when you will be out. I would take these messages back to the POs, most of whom would just laugh and roll their eyes about how, and say how prisoners, quote, do that all the time. Do what, I would think? Panic about their confinement? At least in prison, one knows the general duration of their incarceration. In jail, not so much. On one of my last visits to the jail in Bellingham, I came upon the aftermath of a cell extraction. A cell extraction is a form of punishment and is the human equivalent of pulling a tooth. The tooth being the inmate, the dentist being about 4 to 5 guards in full riot gear, the mouth being the cell, and the tools being batons, fists, clubs, whatever. Men are pulled from their cells and beaten bloody in the process. The man I saw post-extraction was being dragged by his armpits backwards, with heels dragging the floor by 2 guards in full riot gear. The rage on his face was inhuman, twisted and wet with sweat. His teeth were bared, and like a rabid dog, he was frothing at the mouth, literally. They dragged him away. I don't know what happened to him. When you've seen something like that, when you know what goes on in small towns and jails in Washington State, you know its reality is duplicated and augmented thousands of times over in this country alone. When you know this, your perception changes. For many, their perception becomes ill, tainted with corruption, malice, hatred for their clients, hatred for their families and for happiness. At the very least, cynicism, callousness, lack of empathy seeps in. But for some, perception becomes more compassionate, richer, greener, brighter. When you see that colors can change, that the world can turn from crisp sun, blue sky, vibrant green life, to sepia darkness, to gray tones and grime and beige walls with no hope and life inside, you come to appreciate the beauty. Rather than transcend, embrace the reality of the world and become it in the fullness of despair and elation, and know they are in fact one and the same. Willing suspension of disbelief. I will do that for Buffy, but I think as a society we are far too willing to suspend our disbelief of the atrocities of the U.S. penal system. Too bad there are not more Buffy the Vampire Slayers around. The question would be, though, who and what is evil? Perhaps the hell mouth is open and its form is our correctional institutions. If no Buffy, it's up to us to close these hell mouths, question the reality of good and evil, and redefine how we treat our people. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Ivan Hale.
Thank you, Ivan. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. It's common knowledge that among industrially advanced nations, the U.S. is by far the most religious. The secularizing trends that accompanied rising levels of education and declining parochialism in other industrialized nations has failed to take hold on this side of the Atlantic. But Adam Lee, in a piece entitled, You Wouldn't Believe How Fast Americans Are Losing Their Religion, sees a rapid decrease in religious affiliation among Americans. This is a positive trend. But the news is not all good, as he goes on to note that as their power declines in America, fundamentalists are moving to developing countries, not as far along the secularization curve, and they're causing massive damage. Sometime last year, Lee writes, the U.S. quietly passed a milestone demographers have long been predicting. For the first time in its history, this country is no longer majority Protestant. Fewer than 50% of Americans now identify as Protestant Christians of any denomination. This change has come on surprisingly recently, and from a historical perspective, with breathtaking speed. As recently as 1993, almost two-thirds of Americans identified as Protestants, a number that had remained stable for several preceding decades. Whether it's the mainline Protestant denominations like Methodists, Episcopalians, Lutherans, or Presbyterians, or the independent, evangelical, charismatic, and fundamentalist sects, the decline is happening across the board. What's happening to these vanishing Protestants? For the most part, they're not converting to any other religion, but rather are walking away from religion entirely. It seems likely that this is the same secularizing trend being observed in Europe, as people who advance peaceful democracies find religion increasingly irrelevant to their daily lives. The spokespeople of the Religious Light have noticed this trend as well, but it's clear they have very little idea what to do about it. In a column from 2005, Albert Moeller, the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, declared that theological liberalism is at fault for Christianity's decline, and that the only thing they need to do is reverse it. To reverse it is to make a bold commitment to biblical authority. Far from it, the evidence is clear that churches clinging to antiquated dogma are part of the problem, as young people turn away from their strident decrees about gays and women. But the fifth soldiers of fundamentalism haven't been entirely idle these past few decades. As their power declines in America and Europe, they're increasingly moving abroad to developing countries not as far along the secularization curve, where they often find a more receptive audience. The first example is Uganda, where the most despicable kind of American culture warriors have run amok with horrifying results. Since 2009, the country's parliament has been debating an anti-homosexual bill, which, among other things, would establish a crime of aggravated homosexuality, punishable by life imprisonment or death. What's less well known is that three influential American preachers visited the country a month before the bill was introduced, giving talks about how the gay movement is an evil institution which seeks to prey on children, destroy the moral fiber of the people, and abolish marriage and the family, and replace it with a culture of sexual promiscuity. One of these evangelists boasted that their campaign was a nuclear bomb against the gay agenda in Uganda, and later admitted to meeting with Ugandan lawmakers to help draft the bill, although he professed ignorance of the death penalty provision. Other American evangelicals have also expressed their support for the so-called Kill the Gays bill. American evangelicals have spread their poisonous influence to other African countries as well. Uganda, Nigeria, and Kenya, three major English-speaking African nations, have also been the brunt of this effort. Africa isn't the only place the American religious right is trying to exert influence. Pat Robertson's legal group, American Center for Law and Justice, has branches in Russia, France, Pakistan, Israel, and elsewhere, and recently opened a branch office in Brazil. If its American counterpart is any clue, the BCLJ will devote its time mainly to fighting against the expansion of rights for gay and lesbian people and advocating laws that give Christianity special privileges. And when they seize the reins of government here in the U.S., religious conservatives haven't hesitated to spread their views through hard power as well as soft. The most consequential example is the Mexico City policy, also known as the Global Gag Rule. This rule, which was first enacted by Ronald Reagan and since then has been repeatedly reinstated by Republican presidents and canceled by Democratic presidents, states that any group which takes money from American aid agencies can't perform abortions, refer women to other groups to provide them, or even lobby for more permissive abortion laws in whatever countries it operates in. The point of all this is that stopping the religious right is a global issue. The harm they do in America isn't trivial, but they do far greater harm in developing countries where constitutional protections aren't as strong and where American money exerts an outsized influence. If you can't stop them here, there are people all over the world who will suffer much worse repercussions. The most optimistic way of viewing this is that when we defeat them at home, we weaken them abroad as well. When they lose elections in the U.S., they can't control foreign aid money to restrict women's right to choose. When we expose them as bullying, homophobic bigots, when we chip away at their following, we deny them the flow of donations they use to spread prejudice in developing nations. For better or worse, what happens in America resonates throughout the world. That's why standing against the religious right is a moral imperative, not just for the sake of people in the first world, but for the sake of people everywhere in the world. That was an article by Adam Lee, who is a writer and atheist activist living in New York City. You can follow him on Twitter or subscribe to his blog, Daylight Atheism. And now concluding our program today, Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Joe Clement are here to review the film version of the classical Jazz Age novel by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Before we do that, we're going to listen to a little bit of R.E.M.'s losing my religion. That was R.E.M. With a song called Losing My Religion. And now, concluding our program today, movie polls, Chan Hawken and Joe Clement are here to review the film version of the classic Jazz Age novel by F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Great Gatsby. But first, to set the mood...
Directed by Baz Luhrmann, The Great Gatsby is one of a long series of Hollywood productions based on this classic American novel written by F. Scott Fitzgerald and published in 1925. Set in New York City and the plush Long Island shore during the Jazz Age, the film opens with writer Nick Carraway, played by Tobey Maguire, languishing in a psychiatric asylum where he takes up the pen to recover from alcoholism and depression. The psychiatrist prescribes writing as therapy, which is the device of the film for entering the story of the novel. The film centers on Nick Strain's relationship with Jay Gatsby, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, the mysterious rich man at the center of Fitzgerald's moral tale. Nick has taken a cottage next door to Gatsby's mansion while he attempts to establish himself as a stockbroker in the city. Gatsby holds lavish parties and arranges to meet Daisy, played by Carey Mulligan, and cast as the longtime object of Gatsby's fixated desire. Flashbacks tell us the story of how Gatsby had courted the alluring Daisy when he was an army officer during the First World War, and how, penniless, he had lost her to a rich man. Gatsby obsessively pursues this elusive object of his affections, with more glitter and glamour on display than her husband can provide in his own grand mansion across the sound. He succeeds in briefly winning this woman, embodiment of the moneyed world of the jet set of the Roaring Twenties. The film follows the tragic downfall of Gatsby and the carelessness of his super-rich friends, who abandon him in the end, fleeing as well the destruction they carelessly create and leave in their wake. Well, Joe, we don't need to worry about spoilers in discussing this film since, number one, many people read Great Gatsby in high school and know the story. And number two, most are there for the stage work and the wow of the cinematography and the 3D effects than in the subtleties of the story and its denouement. So I think we're free to talk about what the film does with this story and the history it invokes without risking spoilers.
Well, it's kind of sad that it doesn't really actually do, I think, as much as it could with this story, because it is not a new story in American literature or film to be talking about the foibles of the rich or to even talking about the seediness of the new money that is pumping out of Wall Street, and the fact that it stays so true to the book in certain respects, even typing out words, there's kind of a kitschiness to it where we don't really feel like we understand what is seedy about money here. It's a very different world of money.
And I think that's something I struggled with in watching it and thinking about it, that it's the effects are dazzling, and the stage work and the over the top glitter and glamour of it are quite hypnotic. And so we have to ask ourselves, what's the problem here? I mean, there is a moral vantage point on this world. There's clearly a critical, a condemnation of the rich, including in the decline, their decline at the end. And so I think for me, it was a lot of the problem centered on the use of the narrator. Nick, who is introduced in the Fitzgerald book as telling a story and coming to some kind of critical wisdom at the end about the whole American project and trajectory of progress and the illusions created through the commodity culture. In this film, Nick, the narrator, is an innocent in this land and remains an innocent throughout. And I think, tellingly, at the end of the film, he's back in this asylum, a kind of gratuitous effect of the film and not included in the book. But in the film, he's asleep at the end, satisfied that he's told this story. And I think it reflects the point of view of the filmmaker that the film does kind of put us to sleep and doesn't awaken us to the critical perspectives Fitzgerald brought to the novel. The last part of the Great Gatsby is elegant writing. It's very different from these words that you see sprawled across the screen in this stupid way. We're reminded this is a classic, to give it a panache of culture. But there's a tragic perspective at the end that's utterly evacuated from this film project.
Yeah, a lot of the dialogue, at least for the first half, I wasn't quite paying attention to it this way for the second half, but a lot of the dialogue is very rushed. There's a certain way in which the film is not confusing, but the actors, the characters, seem confused. And I think that really is kind of an artifact of trying to translate that book, which is much more subtle, and I think it's been a long time since I read it, but it's much more compelling than the way that they rush through these scenes with a lot of the characters. And the spectacle is, well, we're asked to enjoy it, I think, more than be critical of it or to, you know, find its allures to themselves be dubious. And that is where you see a big difference between the film and the book, is that the book is bringing a critical, or there is a critical distance from it, or eventually that distance is found. Whereas in the movie, it's just kind of a bubble that explodes, but we don't have any distance from it.
Yeah, we leave the theater kind of drunk with too much champagne, and it's not a clear the morning after what's to be learned. There are elements to the film that are carried from this novel into the film that I think contribute to its ongoing allure. I mean, there are many divisions that are historical divisions, cultural divisions between the classes, the old wealth, new wealth, a world, a pre-World War II or pre-emancipation period of women, the Southern belle versus the modern woman, who in the book plays a much larger role as a love object of Nick, the narrator, the world between the West and the East. So it navigates quite a bit of cultural terrain and historical terrain, even though it leaves us, I think, at the end with not much to say about where we've gone.
Well, yeah, it's a great modernist novel, and so it's very Fitzgerald was very aware of big changes that were happening in the United States and in Europe over the last 100, 150 years, and that plays itself out in the fact that we have this man of established money, of well-bred money, of well-cultivated money.
Daisy's husband.
Tom Buchanan. And then we have James Gatz, or James Gatsby, as he'll eventually call himself, who, you know, apparently has some guile and can learn to talk like the rich. He learns from a millionaire who he saves in some kind of boating accident. And then it's not very clear how he gets his money, but other than that, it's dubious and it's probably through bootlegging. They never really established that very well.
In the book, it's drawn out more, and in actually in kind of anti-Semitic line of the story about the Jewish businessmen and they're selling, they're dealing in bogus bonds.
Yeah, and the Nick Carraway character is a Wall Street broker of some sort, and that is one place where I think the movie could have done better to kind of contextualize what was really different about Wall Street back then. I mean, Wall Street's been around for much longer than that even. But when we think of a more contemporary Wall Street movie like the movie Wall Street, Nick is not a dubious character. Nick is just a hardworking American taking a job. And that a lot of the perspective on money that's coming through this movie, through this story, is wealth itself, like accumulated money that is its own autonomous thing. And then people inhabit that, either in the old world values or this new world value.
We don't see where all that wealth is generated in
exactly.
The film.
And yet we have somebody in the story who is very connected to something we all recognize as a great source of wealth, namely Wall Street. And I think that there's going to be a disconnect for audiences over, you know, what's the meaning of this of his participation in Wall Street, because they don't go anywhere with it.
There are a number of user reviews which can be interesting to read beyond the published reviews, film reviews, who say, you know, this is just a love story. Set aside the social critique of Fitzgerald and just enjoy the film as basically a love story. And I think it might be good to talk a bit about what kind of love story it is. I mean, on one level, it is about a fixation on a woman and a possessive form of love that by contemporary standards would send up a lot of red flags about this as not being about love, but a horrible possession of a woman who is an object for him. And the film also, the novel also advances this idea that her voice resonates with money. And he describes his not only fascination, but kind of breathless passion for her, as really she's the embodiment of a moneyed world itself.
Yeah.
And rather than dirty money, it also represents clean money. He comes out of a world of the bootlegging and hustling and the dirt of the streets. And it's sort of this, the novel, there's much more about dirty money, and she really represents kind of clean money. She's her color, her clothes, everything about her is kind of squeaky clean and yet sexually alluring.
Yeah, it's a very strange fixation that he has. He meets her at a party as an officer who just came, probably an enlisted man who came back from the war. And it's love at first sight, and they then part for years. And apparently Gatsby has this ongoing belief that she loves him and that he knows that he loves her. But I don't think that I've ever heard a story of such kind of unrequited or unaccomplished love since Dante and Beatrice, and they never saw each other. It's very unbelievable, and it, I think, plays into kind of the very fantastical weight that the old world values concerning love and courtly love especially weigh on this young man who thinks that he has to build himself up in order to win her affections.
And I think the film, the gender themes, which also include a woman who's clearly cast as a modern woman. She's an athlete. She's described both in the book and appears in the film as very lean and angular and forceful. She's the love interest of the narrator in the book, but in the novel, she's part of many backdrops to the love story. And yet I think in the 20s, after women won the vote and the and the collapse of a lot of the old world patriarchy and the emergence of a new world, there was a crisis about gender and questions about relationships between men and women that Fitzgerald was taken up with. So you have these competing representations of women. But the real love object, of course, is this woman who can be possessed by the biggest bidder. And I think the discomfort with a truly emancipated woman was at the center of the novel and probably Fitzgerald's life, as well as I think still there in the culture. That's part of seeing this as a love story, as a compelling love story.
Well, we're getting close to the end. I don't know whether we would suggest people go see this on the big screen unless you were really into 3D effects. I personally wasn't very impressed by the cinematography, but I generally don't go into movies that boast their cinematography expecting much.
Do we have a minute? I think it would be nice to read a few lines that the novel concludes with by Fitzgerald, because it's in stark contrast to the glitz and glitter of the film itself, with the narrator ending up asleep, Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow will run faster, stretch out our arms further. And one fine morning, and then he concludes, and it's a call for us to question our vision of the past and our confusion of the past and possibilities of a fantasy future that fail us in commodity culture.
Well, I've been Joe Clement and talking with Jan Hocken about the movie adaptation, I think the fourth one now, of F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic novel, The Great Gatsby, for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Jan and Joe. That was Joe Earl Morton's Black Bottom Stomp. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is KBOO 90.77 FM. Coming up next at 10, Air Cascadia is off. We'll hear reports from Between the Lines on the real IRS scandal and the move to stop the Koch brothers' takeover of Tribune newspapers. At 10:15 on Locust Focus, host Barbara Bernstein interviews David Masakowitz, a wildlife tracker, photographer, and outdoor educator who helped establish the Cascade Citizen Wildlife Monitoring Project. At 11, on a special edition of Health Watch, Dr. Navin Naiman hosts an extended interview with author Michael Pollan about his new book, Cooked, an investigation of how cooking involves us in a web of social and ecological relationships. At 11:40, on the Radio Zine host, Ron Green speaks with Michael Faith, executive director of Living Yoga, about the 2013 Yogathon and reaching adults and teens in prison and alcohol treatment centers, yoga style. Thank you.
From farms in Oregon's fertile Willamette Valley to the food desert of inner city Richmond, California, a new documentary film, Gaining Ground, reveals the ingenuity and courage of urban and rural farmers committed to serving and empowering their communities.
Boy, unless people figure out that we need to feed our neighbors locally and sustainably, I don't know what they're going to be farming in a few years.
We live in a classic food desert. People go to their liquor stores, their corner stores, whatever. Food is an issue.
On Saturday, June 1st at 7 p.m., the Media Project presents a short preview of Gaining Ground, a film by Elaine Velasquez and KBOO host Barbara Bernstein. This benefit to raise finishing funds for the film takes place at the Fifth Avenue Cinema, 510 Southwest Hall Street in downtown Portland. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio, Food and Water Watch, Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and the West Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District. More information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the events page.
Of controversies or scandals, depending on your political perspective. They include questions about White House talking points in the aftermath of the September 11th attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that killed four Americans, the Justice Department's covert collection of Associated Press reporters' phone records in the course of investigating a government leak related to a foiled terrorist plot, and the Treasury Department admission that staffers at the Internal Revenue Service Cincinnati office had selected Tea Party and conservative groups for extra scrutiny of their 501c4 nonprofit status applications. One of the contributing factors in the IRS controversy revolves around the lack of clarity in tax regulations governing requirements to be awarded 501c4 status, compounded by the flood of groups, many on the right, that have made applications since the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. election campaigns. Your reporter spoke with Alex Seitz-Wald, Salon.com's political reporter, who examines the factual context of the IRS controversy and the need for tax code and campaign finance reform.
So what happened here is that after Citizens United, there was this explosion of new groups filing under 501c4 of the tax code. 501c4 gives you a little bit more leeway to get involved in politics, but you're still supposed to be, your primary purpose is still supposed to be a social welfare organization. But there's kind of a loophole in that the IRS has never defined what that means, where you draw the line at primary purpose. So a lot of groups, both on the left and right, but especially on the right after Citizens United, formed under this tax code. And what it allows you to do is spend unlimited amounts of money and not disclose any of your donors. So it's natural that the IRS would want to go after these groups and kind of figure out which were genuine social welfare groups and which were political groups in disguise, you know, exploiting this tax loophole. What they did is they said, well, look at all these Tea Party groups forming. Let's flag, you know, groups that have the words Tea Party or defend the Constitution or educate about American history, a few other keywords that are kind of associated with the conservative movement. They said, let's flag those for extra scrutiny because those are, you know, more likely than not going to be political groups instead of genuine social welfare groups. And that is wrong in that, you know, you can't single out any kind of group for scrutiny. And that certainly deserves merit. And I think the Inspector General's report from the Treasury Department, if you read it, is very fair and judicious and rightly criticizes the IRS for engaging in that behavior. But this is hardly the kind of, you know, Watergate-level conspiracy theory that we're talking about. There's no indication that this rose to the White House, and indeed it would be completely illegal for the White House to even be involved in kind of lower-level functioning of the IRS thanks to Watergate. After Nixon used the IRS to go after targets, there were laws created that made it very difficult, and there's only two political appointees in the entire IRS now in order to limit political meddling. So there's no way to tie this to the White House at all. This is sort of mid-level bureaucrats in the IRS doing this. And the more we learn about it, we learn that they went after liberal 501c4 groups as well, far fewer of them than Tea Party groups, but still several of them. So I don't see any kind of political vendetta or any kind of systematic effort to target conservative groups for the sake of targeting conservative groups. I see mid-level bureaucrats given almost no direction on how they're supposed to do their job in determining what's a legitimate political group and what's a social welfare group, and doing the best they can in a poor way, and then, you know, rightly getting in trouble for it. But this is much less sexy than I think the media is trying to make it.
There are many observers of this current controversy with the IRS who point to what they believe to be a more important scandal, and that's the IRS code itself in dire need of reform, along with our system of campaign money, which was, of course, exacerbated by the Supreme Court Citizens United decision. There are people who are concerned, and you wrote a column about this, that this will have a chilling effect on any future scrutiny of groups on the right, particularly, but maybe any political group, and that whatever these organizations are doing in the name of their 501c4 status may be untouchable. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is the real scandal here. The whole reason that this happened is because the IRS has never defined what makes you a social welfare group or what makes you a political group. That line desperately needs to be drawn. Now, with the IRS under so much scrutiny because of this, I think it's politically impossible. And, you know, every campaign finance expert that I speak to says the same thing begrudgingly and